Welcome to Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, a podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. TIPQC exists to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants in Tennessee through our quality collaborative that will identify opportunities to optimize maternal and infant outcomes across our state and is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. The Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast is designed for medical professionals and for patients and families across the state. We will focus on all aspects of the perinatal period with special attention to reducing our maternal mortality rate. This podcast is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health.
Welcome to the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee podcast brought to you by the Tennessee Initiative for Perinatal Quality Care. I am Lindley Wolf, a maternal fetal medicine doctor and a state leader for the TIPQC Cardiac Project. We are excited to have Dr. Carrie Brackney join us today, a maternal fetal medicine physician in Memphis. Dr. Brackney has been practicing as a perinatologist in Memphis for 3 years. But for her MFM fellowship, she worked as a general OBGYN for 9 years. She works for Regional One Health and the University of Tennessee Health Science Center, caring for women with high-risk pregnancies. We are so honored to have you join us today and your willingness to share. Welcome, Dr. Brackney. Let's just start out by, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Dr. Wolf. Just like you, I'm a maternal fetal medicine doctor, and I really love walking with women through their complex pregnancies. Whether it's the mom who has a medical condition or some type of pregnancy complication, or whether the fetus has some kind of diagnosis that we're working through, I really love some of the detective work that goes into caring for these conditions and figuring out what's going on. But I especially enjoy helping women to find joy during the challenges that they face throughout their pregnancies.
Oh, that is such an incredible job. I love my job. I know you love your job. And a big part of our job has to do, in our high-risk pregnancies, has to do with diabetes as well as obesity, which brings us to our topic of today. Let's talk a little more about these new medications that everyone is hearing about. They're called GLP-1 medications. They are certainly on the rise. And I truly feel that they have been revolutionary in people for people who struggle with their weight. What are these medications? Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, GLP-1 receptor agonists are medications that are, at least historically so far, given by injection. And they work by activating receptors called the glucagon-like peptide 1 receptors. And so really what they do is they mimic the action of this glucose-dependent polypeptide, and they work by regulating a mom's blood sugar, reducing appetite, and then slowing digestion. So they mimic the natural hormones that are released by our gut when we eat, and then that results in an increased amount of insulin secretion, and it's really dependent upon the glucose levels in the blood. And then it also leads to a reduced liver production of glucose. It also increases our muscle sensitivity to insulin. It acts on the brain's satiety centers so that we feel full earlier, and it reduces our appetite. And then these medicines also work by slowing the rate of the stomach emptying so you feel full for a longer amount of time.
Wow, that is certainly a lot of different mechanisms of action, as we say in medicine. I think that they've been around for a while, for use in diabetes, but in maybe the last 4 or 5 years they've been really used for weight loss?
I agree. It's been the last handful of years. And these medicines, you're right, it used to be just for diabetes. Now they are being used to treat obesity. And then also I'm seeing them being used in patients with cardiovascular conditions or kidney disease, because it's really been shown to decrease some of the complications in those conditions too.
I think I also recently heard that it was approved for people who are overweight and then have sleep apnea. So I truly do believe as we get further into the knowledge about the medications, we'll see more and more indications.
Yeah, I think these medicines are going to become more and more popular, especially as they become more affordable, because right now I think one of the biggest barriers is their cost.
Yes, that is certainly true. Well, what are the other benefits, or what has the study shown about, and especially in regards to weight loss and diabetes?
Two of the more popular medicines, semaglutide and tirzepatide, have shown a potential for over 10% of weight loss in people with and those without type 2 diabetes. And then the medication liraglutide has shown a range of about 5 to 15% of total weight loss, which is really pretty impressive. And then, like I mentioned before, they also show benefits in atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease complications and chronic kidney disease complications without some of the side effects that we see with other diabetes medicines, because some of those medicines really cause side effects of low blood sugars, which make people feel pretty awful. And these really don't do that, which is pretty neat.
Speaking of side effects, what are some of the other side effects that are common that we may hear about with these medications?
The most common side effects that we hear about are nausea and constipation, and I do think they are quite common, but also I think they're treatable and many folks kind of adjust to them over time.
That makes sense. So you threw out a couple of names, and I know in medicine we often use the generic names. That's how we're all trained. But for our listeners out there, let's talk about what are some of the common names of these medications that they may be aware of.
Yes. So there are several different medications that are being used, and each of them has one or two or even three different brand names. So semaglutide is Ozempic or Wegovy or Rybelsus. Dulaglutide is Trulicity. Liraglutide is Victoza for diabetes or Saxenda for weight loss. And then tirzepatide is the same thing as Mounjaro. But that one is slightly different because it has two different medications in it. It has the GLP-1 receptor antagonist and then another hormone called GIP as well.
Oh, yeah. So all of these names, I think, we've seen them on Facebook or on the internet or on advertisements, TV. They're kind of everywhere. And I truly don't know the answer to this, but do you know the difference between these that are manufactured or that are coming from the companies, the drug companies, versus the ones that are compounded?
I don't know exactly the differences, but I do know that compounded medications are typically not regulated by the FDA. And so in general, they're not considered as safe because no one is testing them to confirm that they are what they say that they are or that the doses are truly accurate. And so for that reason, I still would recommend to my patients that they stick to the medications from the manufacturers. But again, I understand they're not cheap.
Yeah, I'm hoping that and with future changes in medicine, that these are something that will be more affordable and available to everybody that it can be indicated for. But let's change course and talk a little bit about pregnancy. You mentioned earlier about the 10 or 5 to 15% weight loss. And we've always said, I've always said in order people who are struggling with getting pregnant, if they do have a little extra weight, that just losing 10% of your body weight can really help with fertility and help them to achieve pregnancy. So pregnancy has definitely been something that's, you know, wasn't it Ozempic that they called the Ozempic, or no, it's the Ozempic babies that has been a big thing out there. Everybody's hearing about these Ozempic babies. So what is it Ozempic that makes women, is it the weight loss or is it the mechanism? What is it that's making women become more pregnant when they're on this medication?
Those are great questions. And I don't think we know the answers to the full extent at this point, but we do know that obesity in general reduces fertility for women. So women who are obese have a 3 times higher risk of infertility, and they have a much higher risk of stillbirth or miscarriage. Miscarriage rates go up by about 40% for women who are obese. The other issue with obesity is that it's a disruptor for artificial reproductive technologies. So patients who are on medications to get pregnant or having IVF, those who are obese have a 20% lower live birth rate. And there are lots of different mechanisms for that. We know that obesity results in increased levels of leptin hormones in the bloodstream, as well as decreased levels of adiponectin. And those hormones work to regulate our metabolism, our reproductive hormones, and they also affect inflammation around the body. And so all of these things probably contribute to a very complex interaction that ultimately results in differences in fertility. And so if we have folks taking these medications and they have significant weight loss, theoretically, it really should increase their ability to get pregnant and oftentimes their ability to ovulate regularly. And so, you know, if they're not taking contraception, you know, they may have thought they were infertile for a long time, and then all of a sudden they lose weight and suddenly become pregnant.
That seems to have been the trend for sure. Also, like, isn't there some interaction with birth control pills, like, and the slowing of the, can you tell us a little bit about, and the slowing of the gastric emptying? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we do know that these medications may interfere with the way that contraceptives are distributed throughout the body. And so women maybe have higher chances of contraceptive failure while they're taking these medicines. And so that also could contribute to unanticipated pregnancies in this patient population.
So it sounds like it's overall better health along with weight loss and maybe some issues with our birth control that end up leading to these Ozempic babies. What is the current recommendation for if someone comes to you for like preconceptual counseling and they're on these medications? What is the current recommendation for use in pregnancy?
I recommend to my patients that they discontinue GLP-1 receptor antagonists at least a month or two before trying to get pregnant. And I'll be honest, there's not great data to say one way or another what the ideal timing is. But we do know that most of these medicines, because they are a weekly injectable, they are going to hang around in the body longer than, say, you know, a typical daily pill that someone might be taking. And so, you know, giving it a little bit of time to wash out and then therefore not have any effects on the baby would be ideal. I think the other big piece of it is, particularly for women who are taking this for diabetes, what we don't want is for them to stop their medication and then their blood sugar to really spike. And so for those women, I really want them to not only stop their GLP-1 medication, but then also switch over to something that's safe in pregnancy and ensure that they've got really good glycemic control, because we know that high blood sugars increase the rate of birth defects for babies, and then they also increase the rates of miscarriage.
Have there actually been any studies on pregnant women that you know of?
All we have so far is retrospective data, meaning that women who have been exposed to this medication, we've looked at some of their outcomes, both in women and women who knew they were on these medicines and got pregnant, and those who did it kind of unintentionally. And so we do have some data about that. But really, when it comes to like an actual study to look and see prospectively how these medications affect pregnancy, that we really only have at this point in animal studies.
And what was the actual outcome from the animal studies? Did they have successful pregnancies?
Well, so it turns out they studied these drugs in rats and rabbits, and they gave them medication doses that were pretty similar to what humans would have circulating in their bloodstream. And they gave them tirzepatide. And what they found was that those offspring, so the baby rats and the baby rabbits, had lower fetal growth, meaning the babies were smaller. They didn't grow as well, which kind of makes sense, right? Because the moms were not gaining as much weight, not consuming as much food. And so the babies didn't grow as big. So it does lead to some concerns about whether in humans we would find those same findings. Additionally, there was some evidence that it affected the ossification of the bones, meaning when they go from sort of a cartilage, when they start forming, and then eventually that turns over into hard skeletal bone, that ossification process was delayed, and there were some skeletal differences in the babies. And so that can be a finding that we've seen in the past for women who have been in that rapid weight loss period after they've had like a gastric bypass surgery. And there's some pretty good literature out there about the weight loss surgeries, that women who were in that rapid weight loss period when they got pregnant that they had worse outcomes. So they had higher rates of growth restriction in their babies. They had higher rates of birth defects in their babies. And so it does bring up some concern that if that's the same thing going on in the moms who are taking these medications, that maybe their babies could be at the same risks. But we just really don't know. This is all theoretical and it's all based on animals right now.
I do find the animal studies very, or data, I would say, they're not studies. I find them very interesting. When you think about rapid weight loss, we know that with bariatric surgery, when people are in that rapid weight loss phase, that it's not ideal to get pregnant either. Actually, interestingly enough, one of my partners feels that maybe a future for these medicine may be for excessive weight gain in pregnancy when people are halfway through and they've already gained 40, 50 pounds. I'm not so sure about it, but it's definitely interesting thoughts about what the future may hold for this medication.
That's really interesting. I also really wonder about postpartum use. We don't really know much at all about breastfeeding and postpartum weight loss, but I always think of that as sort of a golden opportunity to optimize a mom's health after she delivers her baby. And, you know, here in Tennessee, women with Medicaid, they have health insurance for a full 12 months. And so I do wonder if maybe there is an opportunity to do some studies for weight management or even diabetes management in postpartum moms, particularly in that first year after they deliver.
I love that idea. Full disclosure, I am a personal user of the GLP-1s and they have very much been life-changing for me. So, and I started them shortly after the birth of my last baby. So I do believe that is a great roadmap that we can think about for the future to consider these in that postpartum period. And honestly, we should be able to study them in that setting a little easier than pregnancy. So hopefully that is out there being done now.
Yeah, I agree. And full disclosure, I too have been taking these medications. Now I'm really in like the weight maintenance phase, but yeah, I mean, I think they're really, really helpful as a tool for a lot of folks. I do think one other thing to think about when it comes to pregnancy and these medications is the risk of rebound weight gain. So we know in some of the literature outside of pregnancy that folks who take the GLP-1 RAs and lose a lot of weight, that if they just stop them suddenly, there is a rebound effect that occurs. They do gain weight. And so, you know, there is some concern that maybe that could happen, which is really not an ideal time for someone to have rebound weight gain right at the beginning of a pregnancy. And so there was actually a study about that that showed that women who were taking a GLP-1 receptor antagonist, if they stopped it at the beginning of pregnancy, about 62% of them had excess gestational weight gain compared to women who weren't taking that medication, about 41% had increased weight gain. And all of the women in the study had diabetes. So they were at risk for excess weight gain during pregnancy, but it seemed like the GLP-1s potentially exacerbated that. And so it's another reason to be cautious about it. If you are somebody who is intending to pursue pregnancy, maybe stopping it right before pregnancy might not be ideal either.
It's so interesting. I literally had a preconceptual consult this week where she is on one of the GLP-1s and she is has multiple comorbidities. And so we were talking about when does she stop her medication? And so I think it was Ozempic, but we were talking about this big balance between what we know, which is not a lot in terms of studies from first trimester, but balancing that against if she were to come off of it and then it take 6 months to get pregnant. Now she's gained weight back, potentially made herself in a more risky situation because of increased risk from blood pressures that have returned or blood sugars that have become bad. So it's really a hard situation to be like when to stop it when people are coming into pregnancy because it works so well to treat so many different conditions. So I do tend to struggle with telling people the recommendation is, yeah, absolutely 2 to 3 months. But people who have consistent cycles, we sometimes talk about like monitoring up until right before kind of stopping with each cycle. And that way you're off for about a month-ish before you're talking about conception. So anyways, it's just an interesting thought about the rebound weight and how it ties into multiple places, not just in pregnancy, but preconceptually before pregnancy and then even after.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think if we could get more data to demonstrate safety, then eventually we could get to a point where we wouldn't ask folks to stop it. I suppose the other option would be to stop your GLP-1 and switch over to a medication like metformin that maybe has more side effects and maybe wouldn't cause as much weight loss, but might at least prevent some of that rebound. And certainly metformin is better studied in pregnancy until we have data to go on down the road.
Well, and this is something we see all the time, probably. When you have somebody, in a perfect world, yes, everyone would stop. But just like the Ozempic babies, people are not realizing they're pregnant until they're maybe at least well into the first trimester or stopped with a positive pregnancy test. What do you tell your patients that come to you that are in that first trimester, did not know they were pregnant, and only got to stop their medication somewhere once they were pregnant, say like 10 or 12 weeks?
Well, I think overall, the data thus far is pretty reassuring. When we look at the folks who were exposed early in pregnancy, we haven't seen any really worrisome issues. And again, particularly when you think about women with diabetes, we know that there are risks to babies if moms have high blood sugars, right? They have a higher risk of miscarriage. They have a higher risk of birth defects. So for the women who have diabetes, you know, you're trading one risk for another if you don't really well control their blood sugar. Now, for women who are taking it for other indications like weight loss, certainly they may be trading one risk of miscarriage for another risk of miscarriage, but not so much the birth defect risk, theoretically, but we don't know yet. And so in general, I would be mostly reassuring to say, hey, we don't have any major concerns to think that this is going to cause any major birth defects, but ultimately we don't really know. And so if we run into any issues, we should report it so that that's in the registries and those can be tracked over time.
I'm certainly hoping that the registries are coming out soon with some information. What kind of long-term data do we have on these medications? I think probably most people have heard the thyroid cancer, I think is what it is that people are worried about. What do you know about long-term data?
I have heard that, although I think the risk of thyroid cancer is still very, very low. And it's primarily in patients who are already at a higher risk for thyroid cancer. Certainly our long-term data is somewhat limited because these drugs haven't been out for all that long. And they certainly rose in popularity here in the United States really just in the last, like you said, 5-ish years, not even 10, really. And so we don't know a whole lot about long-term, but what we do know is the long-term risks of obesity and diabetes. And those are really, really not good, right? We know that obesity increases our risk. Well, both of these disorders increase our risk of heart disease and stroke and hypertension. We know that they decrease our longevity. We know that they decrease our social functioning and our quality of life. And so I think it remains to be seen. But to me, first, you have to prove to me that whatever risks there are worse than all those things, because certainly those are significant risks to people.
I 100% agree with you. And this has been such a wonderful and engaging conversation. Thank you for being with us here today. Just to kind of wrap things up, and we'll end with the pregnancy topic. Like, there are a lot of people out there who are listening that probably are taking this medication or have family members that are. And if they achieve pregnancy and they see, what would you do differently in their pregnancy for someone who'd been taking a GLP-1?
That's a great question. I think that, first of all, like I said, I would start by reassuring them that so far we don't have any major concerning signals that this medication would have any detrimental effect on their baby. And then from there, I would recommend, just like I do to anybody else, an early ultrasound to confirm their pregnancy dating, and then an anatomy survey in that 18 to 22 week timeframe so we can look at the baby head to toe. Not that I expect any birth defects or malformations, but certainly we should look just to be sure. And then after that, it really depends on the underlying reason that the patient was taking that medication in the first place. So if she was on that medicine for diabetes, then I would recommend a fetal echocardiogram so that we could look at her baby's heart, since those moms are at a higher risk to have a baby with a heart defect. And then we would talk about monitoring the baby's growth throughout pregnancy and doing antenatal testing to monitor their baby's well-being throughout the third trimester. We would talk about kick counts. We would talk about glycemic control, all of those things. For a mom who is taking it for obesity, I would really just monitor her gestational weight gain throughout the pregnancy and really help her think through dietary management for both of these patient groups, you know, getting them connected to a nutritionist who can really help them to make wise decisions about their diet. And also for patients with obesity, focusing on the growth of their baby by ultrasound and if they need it, antenatal testing. And then, of course, making good decisions about the timing and the mode of delivery once we get to that point. But most of these moms are going to be able to get to term and have a vaginal birth. And so that would certainly be my goal for them.
What a wonderful way to end our discussion with a perfectly healthy pregnancy and a beautiful vaginal delivery. That's everybody's dream of a pregnancy that you've described for us, especially people who have worked really hard to get to that point or have had struggles in life to get to that point. So thank you for being here with us today. It has been wonderful again to speak with you, and I'm sure all of our listeners out there would agree. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up?
No, but thank you so much for inviting me. This is really fun to chat and to catch up a little bit, even though we are on opposite corners of the state. It's fun that we can do this. And thanks to TIPQC for inviting us to talk about this really interesting topic.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee, presented by TIPQC. TIPQC is funded under a grant contract with the state of Tennessee. Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby Tennessee is brought to you through a cooperative agreement with the Alliance for Innovation on Maternal Health. Do you have ideas for a future guest or topic, or even have a question you would like answered on upcoming episodes? Visit www.tipqc.org, that's TIPQC.org, and click on podcast to submit suggestions and questions to our podcast team. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast to be the first to know when new episodes are available, and find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to stay in the loop with our active projects and other relevant news relating to perinatal health in Tennessee.